We'll hear argument next in case 07751, Pearson versus Callahan. Mr. Sterba?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At the time of the arrest in this case, there were three different federal circuits and two state courts that had established it was constitutionally permissible for a police officer to enter a home without a warrant as a follow-up entry to effectuate an arrest after an illegal drug transaction with a government agent had occurred and probable cause had been established. Although the rule has become known as the doctrine of consent once removed, and the lower courts have advanced various rationales in support of the rule, the name or label is not important. What is important is that the rule is predicated upon well-recognized Fourth Amendment principles, and that at the time of the arrest, the consent doctrine was well established in the lower courts as settled Fourth Amendment law. Thus, irrespective of how this court rules on the constitutionality of the rule itself, the petitioner officers could have reasonably believed that what they were doing was lawful.
Well, because the Fourth Amendment principle of consent was well established. In other words, if a police officer goes to the door and says, may I come in, that is perfectly acceptable. Is that the level of generality that you think you ought to analyze this issue at?
No, certainly we think that the generality of just pure consent is not the level at which it should be determined. In fact, that was the problem with the Tenth Circuit case. But the right has to be defined in a specific, clear way, and the contours of the right have to be sufficiently clear that police officers know that when they engage in the conduct, they know that the work they're doing is unlawful. In this case, Mr. Chief Justice, all of the law that was in existing at the time of the entry was supportive of exactly what the police officers did.
Well, it seems to me that misses the point of the case. I mean, the point of the case is that consent to the police was established. Consent to police informants was not. And that when I consent, I am not consenting to the whole world. If I am consenting to somebody who is not a police officer, that is not equivalent to consenting to a police officer. That's the point of the case. And as I understand it, there was only one case at the time this occurred which equated the confidential informant for the police with the police, and that was the Seventh Circuit case. Isn't that correct?
Justice Souter, we're not contending this is an implied consent case, although that has been a theory that has been advanced in the lower courts. We believe that the way that this was constitutionally lawful, this is really a Lewis case, and that is once you engage in some illegal conduct with a government agent in your home, you have waived any expectation of privacy.
No, but in terms of existing law, that equates the government agent, which in this case is not a police officer but a confidential informant, with a police officer. And it seems to me that's the nub of the case. Is that person equivalent so that consent to one, in effect, is consent to as many police as want to come in? Or is it not the case? And it seems to me what you've got to argue here is that the confidential informant and the police officer, for Fourth Amendment purposes, should be treated as identical.
Absolutely. And we think that.
And there's no clear law on that. That's why we're here.
No.
There's one, at the time this case was, this search was made, as I understand it, there was only one case which held there was such an equivalence. Is that correct?
There are two points, Justice Souter. First of all, with respect to the lawfulness of a confidential.
Well, I want to hear what you say, but just tell me, is it correct that at that time there was one case that held the equivalence?
No, Your Honor. There were actually three out of the Seventh Circuit. The Pollard case out of the Sixth Circuit, which involved a police officer and a confidential.
Which was not
informant.
A circuit case, right?
That is a circuit
district
case.
District case?
That was a circuit court case, U.S. versus
Pollard. So there were three circuit court holdings that the confidential informant was equivalent to a police officer?
There were three out of the Seventh Circuit, Paul, Diaz, and I think it's Asiano, were all confidential informant cases, or the courts ruled squarely that there was no difference between a confidential informant and a police officer.
Okay. Do you have other circuits that held that?
Yes, Your Honor. The Pollard case involved a confidential informant.
Where is Pollard from?
Sixth Circuit.
Sixth.
And they cited in support the confidential informant cases from the Seventh Circuit. We also read Bramble, which is a 1995 Ninth Circuit case, which talked about a government agent, did not draw a distinction between a confidential informant and a police officer, as supportive as well. And that's exactly what Judge Kelly determined in the dissenting opinion in the Tenth Circuit.
Okay. Now, why are they correct? Why should the confidential informant be treated as equivalent to a police officer?
Well, fundamentally, and of course, the test is, for Fourth Amendment purposes, is the Skinner test. But once you are a government agent or a government actor, there really is no material difference in terms of what the confidential informant would do or the undercover police officer would do.
Oh, but there's an enormous difference between the training and the character of a police officer, and as this very case illustrates, the confidential informers are often very shady characters who can't be counted on to be truth-tellers and have a powerful incentive to get someone for the police, because in most cases they're seeking to have their own case dealt with sympathetically. So how can you equate a police officer with a confidential informer who is usually someone who knows where the drug house is because he's a dealer himself?
2 points. In our reply brief, pages 6 and 7, we point out the wide variety of confidential informants. They come in many different shapes.
How about this, the one in this, wasn't this one that fits my description, the one in this case?
This one clearly had a drug problem. This one also attended college. This one also was a star athlete in high school. And this one also was reliable in a previous drug transaction. Moreover,
he was trying to make a deal to get leniency with the police.
Well, there's no question about that. But once again, he's a government actor, and for purposes of Fourth Amendment liability, it really doesn't matter whether he's a police officer or a confidential informant, as long as he's an agent of the government, which clearly he was. He was a government actor.
But you certainly cannot argue. Maybe you are, but I don't see how you can argue in response to Justice Ginsburg that the integrity to be expected from a confidential informant, taking that as a category of the law, including all sorts of informants, is the integrity that we would expect from a police officer.
Well, as a general proposition, Justice Souter, you can't make that kind of determination, as we point out.
Why can't I?
Because sometimes confidential informants are retired police officers. Sometimes confidential informants are police cadets. Sometimes confidential informants.
Then, if that is true, as it clearly is, they run the gamut from the good to the bad. You can't adopt the proposition categorically that confidential informants should be regarded as having the same integrity as a police officer.
I wouldn't want to make that statement. I don't know that's material, though, to the analysis under the Fourth Amendment and whether or not, once you're a government agent or a government actor, there really is no legal significance that flows from that to draw a distinction between one who is actually employed by the police, taking a paycheck from the police, and one who is not.
There's one feature of this that I think is really puzzling. What this case is about is the Fourth Amendment that requires, with certain exceptions, the main rule is you get a warrant. And here you have a confidential informer going to the place to make sure that they really do have the goods. Then he goes back to the police. He spends 2 hours. He's being wired and whatever else. Why didn't somebody pick up a phone and get a warrant at that point? The confidential informer could say, I was there and I saw the drugs. What the whole purpose of these rules is to have the police get a warrant when they can. And how do you explain a 2 hours lapse between when they had probable cause and when the informer returns for the second time?
Well, Justice Ginsburg, the officers testified why they didn't get a warrant, 244 and 245 of the joint appendix, and 256 and 257. Two problems. One, they weren't sure the drugs were going to be there. These are small amounts of drugs in a rural area. They dissipate very quickly.
We're talking about probable cause. If they got a warrant within an hour or two of the time that that informant says he saw them there, do you seriously question whether there would be probable cause?
I'm only going on the record and what these informed officers.
But we're asking for the basis. You're asking for a rule, and our questions go to the reason for having that rule. And the officers may have said, and I will assume they said in this case, oh, gee, we weren't sure the drugs would still be there. But in terms of probable cause law, that's just not a serious answer, is it?
Well, it is. And in essence, we're talking about an anticipatory warrant. And under U.S. versus Grubbs, you not only need probable cause to believe that the drugs will be there.
You don't even need an anticipatory warrant. They need a warrant to go in and search that place on the grounds that there are probably drugs there. And if they saw drugs there a couple of hours beforehand, and they have no affirmative evidence, which they should bring forward under the Frank standard to indicate that the drugs were being taken out, is there any serious question that probable cause would be found properly?
Justice Souter, I don't believe at the time, approximately 9 o'clock in the evening, the police had probable cause to believe the drugs were there.
An informant just came out and said there were drugs there, and they don't have probable cause?
At the time of 9 o'clock, I don't think it was established that there were drugs.
Why not?
I thought it was established even not only that there were drugs, but that he actually tasted some.
He never told the police that. And the purpose of the operation, of course, was to establish that there was, in fact, drugs in the house. The transaction would occur, and that would conclusively establish probable cause. And I don't think we should fault the police for essentially being careful before they entered the home to make sure that, in fact, they had probable cause.
The reason the police are being faulted is that they didn't get a warrant, and the warrant requirement is a generally good starting place for a Fourth Amendment argument. Justice Ginsburg's point is that if they had an informant who had seen drugs in the place within 2 hours, they had they been before a magistrate, the basis in probable cause to get a warrant, and I still haven't heard why, in fact, they couldn't have got one or why they didn't have the probable cause.
Well, as I explained before, they believe the drugs in that.
I'm not interested in what they personally believed. We're talking about objective Fourth Amendment standards. Did they or did they not have a basis to establish probable cause at that point?
We don't believe they did, Your Honor, and we don't believe they could have gotten an anticipatory warrant.
I will admit that is the most astonishing view of probable cause I have heard in this courtroom. Of course they had it.
Well, the record evidence doesn't substantiate that, or they would have gotten.
Why doesn't it?
Or they would have gotten.
Why doesn't it?
Warrant.
As I understand, the record evidence is that their informant was in that guy's home and within 2 hours of the point that we went through the second entry, he had seen drugs. Why wasn't there probable cause within that two-hour period?
Because the police did not believe that at the time that they could have gotten a warrant, that the drugs would not have been dissipated. And they as they testified, the magistrate.
Is that a reasonable belief?
Pardon me?
I mean, we're talking about probable cause, not an establishment of mathematical certainty.
Here's another point. That is just an option, Justice Souter. The police, if you believe the police could have gotten a warrant, they didn't have to get a warrant. They obviously were engaged in a buy-bust operation, which eventually led them to the particular position where they clearly established probable cause.
They clearly would have been if they had sent a police officer in. You're asking us to extend the police officer rule to include a confidential informant rule. One reason for doing so is, or would be, that in practical terms there is a need for it. Justice Ginsburg's question was, why is there a need for it when they could have gotten a warrant? And we still haven't heard an answer.
In rural Utah, and this is page 47 of the Joint Appendix, the officers testified that one of the reasons why they need to use confidential informants is because the police are all known. And therefore, if they're going to engage in any drug
then why didn't they use the confidential informant to get a warrant?
Well, I don't know how I can answer the question any more than I have, Justice Souter.
They
chose not to for reasons they didn't believe they had a probable cause, and they were concerned that the drugs had been dissipated.
Counsel, given the posture of the ultimate issue in this case on the underlying constitutional question, you do not have to prove that you're right. Isn't that correct? You just have to establish that the contrary principle is not clearly established.
That's correct. And the law at the time that these officers engaged in this operation, entered the home, and once again it was based upon probable cause, supported, in fact, constitutionally what they did, and that it was indeed permissible. And that was the basis upon which we believe, irrespective of how the court views whether they should or should not have gotten a warrant and the constitutional implications of that, that the law was clearly not established sufficiently such that these officers are entitled to qualified immunity. That was one of the problems with the Tenth Circuit case.
May I just establish one thing? Tell me if I'm wrong. That this argument about consent once removed was not presented in the lower courts. That is, in the trial court, you argued exigent circumstances, and then on appeal, the inevitable discovery rule. So there was, in the courts below, this was not given as the reason. The consent once removed was not alleged as the basis, as the justification for this search.
That's true. On the criminal appeal, the state did not argue Lewis, didn't argue consent once removed, and that is part of the problem with the number of cases that have been cited by the respondent. They're exigent circumstances cases where the consent once removed doctrine or Lewis isn't even advocated or litigated. We think that's very important. And unless the justices have any other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the police entry in this case was constitutional and in any event did not infringe any constitutional right that was clearly established at the time the officers acted. The mandatory order of decision for qualified immunity cases announced in Saucier versus Katz should be overruled. I did want to begin by clarifying the answer to your question, Justice Ginsburg, because I'm not sure if it was entirely clear. There were really two cases here, one of which was the criminal prosecution of Mr. Callahan, the respondent in this court. And the individual officers were not parties to that case. That was handled by the state of Utah. And you're correct that in the criminal proceeding, the consent once removed argument was not made, and that led to the motion to suppress ultimately being granted, and consequently, Mr. Callahan is not subject to criminal proceedings. Mr. Callahan did file a civil suit against the individual officers who were involved in effecting the arrest, and in that civil proceeding, the consent once removed argument was made all the way up. It was made in the district court, and it was made in the court of appeals as well.
Mr. Stewart, can I follow up on one other thing that came up during the preceding argument? Isn't the issue whether there was or was not probable cause quite separate from the consent once removed doctrine? Assuming that there was probable cause here, there may be many instances in which the consent once removed doctrine would be applied, if it's a valid doctrine, where there wasn't previously probable cause.
That's correct. I think the consent once removed doctrine would have its greatest utility in cases where the police suspect but don't have probable cause to believe that a particular individual is engaged in criminal activity. And so they send an informant or an undercover police officer in to try to either confirm or dispel their suspicions. They wouldn't be able to get a warrant at the outset because they would not have probable cause at that time of ongoing criminal conduct.
But if our question is, should consent once removed be recognized as a doctrine that covers the confidential informant in this case, one question that we may sensibly ask is there a need to recognize that broad a consent doctrine? And one question that would bear on that would be, in these cases, is there a difficulty or impossibility of getting a warrant on a normal probable cause standards? And I think that was the point of Justice Ginsburg's question. Do you doubt that they could have gotten a warrant within the two-hour period?
Well, we certainly think that they had probable cause. There was testimony from police officers to the effect that magistrates in Utah would be reluctant to grant warrants based on these circumstances because of the possibility the drugs would be dissipated. I'm not in a position to second-guess their empirical experience as to the circumstances under which Utah magistrates will and will not grant warrants. But we think as a legal matter there was probable cause and that a warrant should have been issued. But certainly there are plenty of circumstances.
It's not just this case. Maybe you can tell me. I thought because they were dealing with a confidential informant rather than a police officer, they sent him in to do the dry run. I mean, the police officer's case is usually the undercover police officer goes in, the other police officers are there, ready to come in when he gives them the signal. But the police officers don't ordinarily go through this dry run that they had here with the confidential informant.
Well, I would think that with either police officers or with informants, you could have some situations in which the undercover operative has very recently attempted to confirm the presence of drugs, and you could have other cases in which the undercover operative, again, either an informant or a police officer, could hear rumors on the street that a particular individual was engaged in drug dealing, might not have probable cause, and they might decide that the best way to set up the operation was to send this person in to attempt to make a buy at a time when probable cause was lacking. But they would want to arrange the operation in such a way that if the operative's experience confirmed their suspicions and gave them probable cause to arrest, they would be able to go in immediately. And our principal contention is not that the consent to the entry of Bartholomew was implicit consent to the later entry of the police officers. It was that once a person has, even unknowingly, admitted a government agent into his home, his expectation of privacy is sharply reduced, and the entry of the officers works an insubstantial incremental invasion of privacy. And I'd like to return to the point that Mr. Sterba was making. It's true that the informant here lacked the training and skills that, and integrity for that matter, that you would expect a police officer to have. But he was, for Fourth Amendment purposes, a government agent, a state actor. If his handlers had instructed him to look for an opportunity to rummage through drawers.
Mr. Stewart, could I interrupt you because there's something that hasn't been reached? Do you think that we should answer the constitutional question first or the immunity question first?
We think that this Court in this case should address the constitutional question first because it is the subject of a square circuit conflict. It's been briefed and argued. It's a question that independently warrants resolution.
It's quite difficult. I mean, there are we don't know quite a lot about whether they would have gotten the warrant, how dangerous it was, whether the drugs were likely to be hidden. And I was thinking of it, so that's why I'm saying this, as a perfect reason, since constitutional questions in this area are like the stars in the sky. There are so many. Rather than having the judges answer each one and getting everything mixed up, why not just have them take whatever is the easier path? As a judge, I'd like to take what's the easier path.
Well,
if it's easier to deal with the qualified immunity, deal with it and forget the rest of it.
I guess the first thing I would say in response to that is we think that the balance or the way in which discretion will ordinarily be exercised will typically be different in the case of the lower courts than in the case of this court, because the principal role of the lower federal courts is to decide individual cases before them, usually in the most expeditious and non-controversial way they
can. Unless we do that here, they're never going to get the right message. And so what we will have is 1,000 judges trying in an average in a year 50 or 60 cases each with multiple facts, and we will have approximately over a 10-year period hundreds of thousands. I've exaggerated, but there will be many, 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 many conflicts, many, many confusions. And unless we say, no, we're not doing it ourselves, how will they ever get the message?
Well, I think they'll get the message.
They don't always have to do it, but I mean once.
I think they'll get the message if the court tells them that the mandatory rule of Saussure is no longer in effect, that courts have discretion to decide based on their sound judgment. Whether it
why
makes
isn't it? Why isn't it an advisory opinion if we do not have to decide the ultimate question whether this is constitutional or not, but simply whether or not it was clearly established, whether it was unconstitutional? Why isn't it purely advisory opinion to say whether it's constitutional or not?
I mean, in one sense, it's an advisory opinion, but in another sense, there are often cases in which two alternative grounds for decision are proffered, either one of which, if accepted, would compel a judgment in one litigant's favor. And the fact that it would theoretically, if the court concludes in its own.
No. Those are different grounds, it seems to me. Those are too independent, as you said. Here, it's kind of a progression. you first ask either, under somebody's view, I guess, a Saussure view, whether or not it's constitutional or not, and then whether it's clearly established. I just don't know why the first question isn't purely advisory, because you don't have to know whether it's constitutional or not.
Well, it's true that if the court announced that this search was constitutional, then it would necessarily be saying, and there was no clearly established constitutional law to the contrary at the time the officers acted. But the court
— The question. I mean, look, if I have to answer the constitutional question, what bothers me is this consent at one remove. What? You're saying a drug seller who lets in a disguised policeman in order to sell him a drug because he thinks he's a drug is suddenly consenting to the entire LAPD coming into his house? I would think that's the last thing he would have thought about wanting, not the first.
But that would be equally true in the case of the undercover police officer.
Well, maybe they both should be the same.
That's what I wanted to know, and it gets back to the merits, not the Saussure. We're going through two different things here. Assume this is an undercover officer, not an informant. The undercover officer sees a crime being committed. He's ready to make the arrest. Can he automatically ask for police assistance, and are the police then entitled to come into the home, in your view, or do there have to be some exigent circumstances?
No, we think he could automatically ask for the police to come into the home, because the incremental intrusion on privacy by having several police officers rather than one to make the arrest would be insubstantial.
But isn't the reason it's insubstantial is that we have a rule for independent reasons, having nothing necessarily to do with this kind of situation, in which one officer's knowledge is regarded as another officer's knowledge. The police are regarded as a group. So that we have a rule ready in place saying, you show one, you've shown the whole department. We don't, however, have any such rule with respect to agents generally.
I think you don't have that precise rule, but it is nevertheless the case that the undercover operative here, the informant, was a state actor. Had he been instructed to look in private places without consent, his conduct would have constituted a Fourth Amendment violation, because he would have been regarded for that purposes as an agent of the state, and he should therefore be regarded as a state agent for these purposes
as well. Just to be clear, if I may, I know your red light's on. Your position is that if an undercover officer is in the premises, sees a crime being committed, he automatically can invite police in to assist him in making the arrest without exigent circumstances.
That's correct.
What authority do you cite me for that?
I don't think this court has ever squarely so held. I believe that the respondents concede that because they don't take issue with the fact that consent once removed is applicable when the person already inside is an undercover police officer.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Metzler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is a case about consent. By consenting to the entry of a confidential informant, did Mr. Callahan consent to the entry of police? The answer is no, and no reasonable officer could have believed otherwise. This court has long held that it is presumptively unreasonable for police to enter a home without consent or exigent circumstances or a warrant. Here, there were no exigent circumstances, there was no warrant, nor was there any consent.
Was Mr. Stewart correct that you concede that if this person entering the house were, in fact, a police officer, that this would have been okay?
No, Your Honor. We think it's a closer case, but if this confidential informant had been a police officer, it would be the same analysis. There's no exigent circumstance here. There's no consent, and the consent to the police officer in your case would not extend to the.
Well, you would agree he could make the arrest by himself, assuming a police officer.
Yes, he certainly could make the arrest by himself.
But you're saying he can't ask for assistance to make that arrest effective in all cases. There has to be some exigent circumstance.
Correct. If there is some sort of exigent circumstances, in this case, they would have planned that in advance, and police are not allowed to create their own exigency to get around the Fourth Amendment.
And you're advocating a rule that's going to get police officers killed, aren't they? Aren't you? If an undercover police officer in a house making a drug buy, and you want to say that the single officer who's there in an undercover capacity can say, you guys are all under arrest, he can't signal for other police officers to come in and help him effect the arrest without anybody being killed?
Well, of course, the safest alternative would be for him to simply withdraw, get on the telephone, and get a warrant to come back in. Or during the 2 hours that they were planning this entry, he could have gotten a warrant then, or an anticipatory warrant. So there are plenty of safe options.
Well, it seems to me that in the case that Justice Alito put, that there are exigent circumstances.
Well, to the extent that they planned it in advance and the basis of their entry.
Well, that's a different point, and I have some question about that. It seems to me the police are never quite sure exactly what's going to happen.
Well, if they've planned on an exigent circumstance as being the reason that they're allowed to go in, under this Court's decisions, long line of decisions since Peyton and Stiegold saying exigent circumstances or consent are the way to get in without a warrant, then it would not be permissible. If a truly
imagining,
exigent
you're imagining different cases. We can imagine a spectrum of cases. In some cases, the policeman or the confidential informant will be there. And he really couldn't have gotten a thing in advance, a warrant in advance. He wasn't certain. And they're in there, and they see a lot of drug behavior going on. The drugs are going to be hidden, go, disappear the second he leaves. And if he tries to arrest him, everybody's going to jump on him and kill him. Okay? So there are a lot of cases just like this one, but with a few changes, which are he needs to call the police. And there'll be others where he doesn't. So that's why I'm so uncertain about what it is we're deciding here on the merits. We'd have to say on the merits, this is a case where there are no exigent circumstances. Can we say that? I'd not want to say never are there.
Well, I think certainly in this case there were not exigent circumstances. The informant was on his way out the door. He wasn't attempting to make an arrest. No one thought that that Mr. Callahan would destroy the drugs or that anyone would flee. There were no, and in fact, petitioners abandoned exigent circumstances in the Court of Appeals. So I think you can decide this case on the merits, saying there were no exigent circumstances, and then ask, is it reasonable to think that because there was an informant inside, and because he sent out a signal that there was probable cause, a drug transaction had happened inside the house, does that make any difference whatsoever as to whether there was consent? And no reasonable officer.
At least I find it a very difficult question. I do not find it necessarily a terribly difficult question whether that, whatever the answer is, whether it was clearly established, precisely because I find the underlying question difficult. You know, you've got a handful of Court of Appeals decisions. You've got a factual variation. The issue is whether to extend the police coming in to a confidential informant. All those questions are very difficult. But precisely because they are, it doesn't seem that the rule, whichever rule is adopted, is clearly established. Why don't — and yet if I were on the lower Court of Appeals, you would say, or the saucier would say, I've got to decide that very difficult constitutional question and then decide what's a very easy qualified immunity question. Why does that make sense?
With respect, Mr. Chief Justice, I don't think it's a difficult question at all.
Well, I know you don't, because you're arguing one side of it. But when you put the concede for purposes of argument that it is a difficult question. Why don't we just tell the lower courts, we do it, we go right ahead to the qualified immunity question by, you know, granting cert on one. Why shouldn't the lower courts have the same luxury?
Well, with regard to the saucier question, we think that the court should keep the saucier question, and particularly in this case where there's a circuit split, the court should decide the constitutional question and not move on to the clearly established question.
Why? Because we need to provide guidance on that question?
Yes.
Well, it can. Do you think it can't come up any other way?
Well, it certainly could come up in a criminal case.
Or a suit against a political subdivision, right? I mean, you could have sued some other political entity other than the officers individually, right?
Certainly, Mr. Callahan did sue the county in this case. But
it seems to me that this is an area where the police do need guidance. I mean, I need guidance. I find this very difficult. It seems to me that we could have learned a lot if the courts of appeals had addressed this question.
Well, this court, in Peyton and Stiegold, in a long line of cases. I'm sorry, I missed that question.
Which is what they would do under Saucier.
Right. Well, I mean, it's important to address the constitutional question first, in this case and in other cases, in order to make sure that the law continues to elaborate and that potentially meritorious constitutional rights
well,
are
but that
ever
was my question. There are other ways for the law to develop. The issue can come up on the merits in a suit against the municipality, which doesn't raise the qualified immunity question. It can come up if you have a search where the person sues to get whatever was seized back. You know, if there's a and also perhaps, and if the option is if the question of which order to proceed is optional, the law can develop when the courts, for good and sufficient reasons, decide to reach the constitutional question first. I'm just wondering what benefit there is in an absolute, rigid rule that courts of appeals — I mean, I had a few of these cases in the courts of appeals. I thought it was very odd that I had to go and decide a difficult constitutional issue and then not worry about it because in one sentence you say, well, but the issue is not clearly established and so there's qualified immunity.
Well, that would take us back to before Saussure in the court. It's a recent decision. It hasn't proven to be unworkable. And, in fact, the recent
— Well, my point, though, is that at least in my experience it was unworkable or at least frustrating in that we had to decide not just a factual question but a constitutional question in a context where it wasn't necessary.
Well, it depends on your view of necessity. In some cases, certainly, they won't really come up in other contexts. And if the law is not established in a Section 1983 suit, it may never be established. But here, we're talking about a question where there is a circuit split, and the court definitely should provide guidance to the lower courts. I don't think it's a definite.
Well, doesn't the fact that there's a circuit split almost by definition mean that it's not clearly established?
Well, this court has looked to controlling its own precedents and the controlling circuit law to decide what law is clearly established. And here, since Peyton and Stiegel, the court has held that there is a bright line rule. It's very simple for police officers. It's easy for them to understand. If they would like to enter without a warrant, and they don't have exigent circumstances, and they don't have consent, then it is presumptively unconstitutional. And that's a good rule and an easy rule, and it's also why this is not a difficult constitutional question. There are no exigent circumstances in this case, and no reasonable officer could conclude that the presence of a confidential informant inside the house means that there is consent to the police officer.
What if the officers in this case had read the Seventh Circuit decisions, and they said, these are judges on a United States Court of Appeals, and they think that this is consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And what's more, one of these opinions is written by Judge Posner, and he's the smartest man in the world. He knows everything there is to know about law and economics and jurisprudence and literature and many other subjects. Now, it's unreasonable for them to follow that?
Well, I think that officers in the Tenth Circuit need to be aware the way that our federal court system works. And the Seventh Circuit's decision simply isn't binding on the Tenth Circuit. And with all due respect to Judge Posner, he dropped the ball on this one. He said, this is a case where in United States versus Paul, there were no exigent circumstances. The officers there could have gotten a warrant, and he said should have gotten a warrant. But he said this is justified by consent. He's saying that consent to one person is consent to many. And the court's cases have said that consent is based on ordinary social expectations. And when you let one person into your house, you just don't let in the whole world.
Now, so if the Tenth Circuit says this is not allowed, and every other circuit since the Tenth Circuit's decision has held that it is that clearly established that it's not allowed in the Tenth Circuit?
Yes, I think that certainly an officer in the Tenth Circuit would be bound to follow the Tenth Circuit rule. I mean, it's not irrelevant that other courts have decided it differently, but to the extent that there is controlling law in the circuit, I think that they have
and
to
it is irrelevant. Then it is irrelevant that 10
well,
of the circuits have decided it differently.
That very well might wind up in this court if there were 10 to 1.
Well, right. Well, do the police officers get to decide that? Do they get to decide not only that Judge Posner thinks this, but all 10 other circuits think this? And it's been 5 years since the Tenth Circuit. I mean, do they have to go through that type of analysis?
Well, we don't expect officers to survey the entire case law and come up with a law professor's view of whether this is reasonable or not. We expect them to follow the bright lines that this court has set down and that are set down in their home jurisdiction. And if their home jurisdiction says it's unconstitutional, it's not reasonable for them to follow some out-of-circuit decision. If, for instance, the Seventh Circuit had said that a warrantless home entry is okay so long as the officer had breakfast in the last half hour, That's an unreasonable rule, and it wouldn't be reasonable for any officer to follow that. And the facts here are about as relevant to consent as whether there was the officer had breakfast that morning. And so the officers here are not entitled to qualified immunity, nor can they rely on the Seventh Circuit. The petitioners have not given you any good reason to adopt a new exception here. They say that this is based on a waiver theory, or that it's a private search, or that it is incident to arrest. But all of those ignore the substantial interest in the sanctity of the home.
Do any of the other cases involve, the other circuit cases, involve confidential informants as opposed to police officers?
Other than the Seventh Circuit?
Yeah.
The one case in the Sixth Circuit, there was both a confidential informant and a police officer were admitted. And in the later case in the Sixth Circuit that did say this is okay for, which came after the events in this case, but it said it was okay.
So at the time, every circuit other than the, you know, if there's a police officer and a confidential informant, I think that can be considered a police officer because he's going to call the police in. Every court of appeals decision involving a confidential informant said it was okay.
Actually, we cited three circuits where these same facts happened in the Eighth Circuit, the First Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit.
And in those circuits, did the court focus on the distinction between the police officer and the confidential informant?
Well, no. The court looked to whether there were exigent circumstances or consent. The courts followed this court's decision in Payton and Bramble and that line of cases.
Do you believe that what is the appropriate level of generality to look at in addressing this question? Case involving a confidential informant?
I think the appropriate level of generality is that the facts under the court has covered the field when it comes to warrantless home entries. If you have a warrant, you're okay. If you have exigent circumstances, you're okay. And if you have consent, you're okay. Everything else is presumptively unconstitutional. And
it's just, why is that?
Because that's what this court has said many times.
Why isn't it that the issue hasn't come up? This question of a confidential informant is one that hasn't come up. Why would we say that's presumptively unconstitutional?
Well, the court's language is that it's presumptively or per se unconstitutional. It's said that many times. And it's
because you're talking about the main rule for police is get a warrant, accept. And that, I think the court has said a number of times to make the search reasonable. The police have to get a warrant because you want to interject the judicial officer in between the police and the person in jeopardy. So the main rule is warrant, unless, and then you have said the exceptions, but I think your point is there is a main rule.
Yes.
Which this court has gotten from the Constitution. Get a warrant if you can.
Is it your argument that in the situation where the exigent circumstances are the creation of the scenario that the police have set up, the police cannot, and you have a police officer who's the undercover operative who has the power to make an arrest, that police officer cannot signal for other officers to come in and assist with the arrest?
Well, our position is that would be the additional officer's entry would violate the Constitution if there is
additional officers would violate the Fourth Amendment.
Yes.
Even if there's an officer safety problem there.
Well, to the extent that they have created an officer safety problem, obviously the officers are going to go in to help him. No one's going to get hurt. But the additional officer's entry can violate the Fourth Amendment.
And so the police say, you know, we made a mistake. We should have had a warrant. But we have our man in there now. We've got to do something. The police cannot send assistance.
No, of course they can send assistance, and they probably will.
No, but you say they've created the exigent circumstances.
Yes, they have, which is why the additional officer's entry would violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, there might be limited consequences.
So my first statement was correct. It's illegal for the police to send their assistants, the other officers in.
Yes. My answer was, as a practical matter, no police officer is going to leave, even if they
have. Yeah, but then he's going to get sued.
He very well may get sued, and there could be questions of fact as to.
So you say, as a practical matter, we have to say that under the Constitution we must endanger the officer.
Well, I disagree that the officers will be endangered. The safest option.
No, the hypothetical is they have to send people in to assist him. But the hypothetical also is they should have anticipated this, and therefore, in your words, they created the exigent circumstance.
They did create the exigent circumstance. And
it seems to me that that dilemma and that paradox casts considerable doubt on your proposition that if the police create the exigent circumstances, they cannot then rely on them. I seriously question that proposition.
Well, even if you disagree with me on that, it shouldn't make any difference in this case where there was no exigent circumstance.
No, I want to talk about the general rule.
Okay, well, the general – nevertheless,
you want us to write an opinion saying that any time the police create the exigent circumstances, they can't rely on them if they'd had a time to get a warrant. And well, I find that a dangerous rule.
I don't think you would need to write an opinion that would say that because exigent circumstances are not in this case.
Well, Mr. Metzler, what do you say to this line of reasoning? We have in prior cases adopted the position that for purposes of establishing probable cause, the knowledge of one police officer is also the knowledge of all police officers, at least within a department or working on a particular problem. So that if in a case in which there is a search without a warrant, if you add up everything that individual officers knew and that amounts to probable cause, then the search is good. Why don't we apply, in effect, the same rule in the hypothetical case that you have been given, in which it is a police officer who was admitted by consent and there are other police officers outside? At the point at which the police officer who has been admitted has the knowledge necessary for an arrest and has that knowledge as a result of the invitation and the waiver of privacy as to him, why don't we regard that on sort of general doctrinal grounds as a waiver of privacy with respect to the police in general? Just as we regard police knowledge as being imputed to all police officers. That way, you don't have the problem that, for example, Justice Kennedy's hypo raises, even in the absence of exigent circumstances. But it doesn't open the door to what you're objecting to here. Well, why isn't that a proper solution or proper answer to his hypo?
Well, if you were to adopt that sort of, I think that you certainly could adopt that rationale, but I don't think the way to get there is through a waiver, because really there's nothing that the person, the suspect, has done that he knows about that would mean that he waives the expectation that additional people will come in. There might be under a
general... No, you're absolutely right. In terms of his psychological process, the only person he's invited in is the one person. The reason for coming up with the answer I suggested is a broader doctrinal reason, and that is the reason that we have, for probable cause purposes, regarded the police or the knowledge of one police officer as the knowledge of all. Why don't we, for the same reason, since it is privacy that is at stake in all of these cases, regard the invitation of one police officer as the invitation of all?
Well,
or to all.
Again, I don't think that the way to get there is through consent. If you wanted to balance and say, well, the government has an agent in there who is making the arrest, and there are safety concerns and other reasons why we would want to do that, that might be one way to get there. I don't think it's through consent.
Well, it would be consent to the one officer plus a doctrinal basis to construe that consent for Fourth Amendment purposes as a broader consent. That's what we would be doing.
Yeah, well...
We wouldn't be doing it because the individual in the trailer says, I am inviting in the whole L.A. Police Department. We're doing it because he invites one L.A. police officer in, and we have a doctrinal basis for regarding the police, as it were, collectively rather than individually for probable cause purposes when privacy is at stake.
Well, that would certainly be a basis to allow this for police officers. And the
right.
Court could adopt
it. Open the door to, I guess, to what you're objecting to.
Well, why would probable cause solve the problem at all? There's clearly probable cause here. They're listening to what goes on. So do you dispute that when they hear that the drug transaction is taking place, that they lack probable cause?
And no, I think they do have probable cause. But in Payton, the court said that police officers who are outside, who have probable cause, need more than probable cause to get inside. They need a warrant, exigent circumstances.
Right. I think I may have created this problem for you, and maybe I should get you out of it. I'm not suggesting that the probable cause rule is what is operative here. I'm saying that for probable cause purposes, we regard the police collectively. And why, since privacy is at stake there and is at stake here, why shouldn't we have a collective consent rule, too?
You certainly could adopt that rule.
That was my proposal.
You certainly could adopt that rule, and that would be an additional reason for police to enter beyond what has been thus far established by this court.
How do you decide whether the confidential informant should be considered an employee of the police? Let's say this is the 10th undercover operation he's engaged in. They give him $100 after every undercover operation. I mean, is he an employee of the police department?
I don't think his employment status is what's at issue. The question is whether he is an agent of the state for the purpose that he is inside the for the purposes of making an arrest of the person inside the home. Here, the confidential informant, all he's really doing is acting as a surveillance device. He's telling the officers outside what's happening inside, and he gives them probable cause.
Why doesn't make him an agent of the police?
No, I don't think so. He might be an agent for some purposes, but he's certainly not an agent for the purpose of making the arrest inside, which is what they want to do.
What if there's a state statute that says that confidential informants may be designated by the police department to assist in making arrests?
If there were something to assist in making an arrest of the government, then assuming that we're following Justice Souter's new exception, then I think that they would fall into that exception. But here, of course, the confidential, there was no such thing. This confidential informant was not acting for the police. He wasn't making an arrest. There was no
He wasn't doing it on his own. He was acting for the police. He didn't decide, I'm going to do this because, you know, I want to do it, and just so happens the police are involved as well.
Well, that's true. He was acting with police, but he wasn't acting for the police. And nothing that the confidential informant did inside, even if attributed to police, would give the police the right to cross that threshold. If this confidential informant were a police officer, I think you would have to base it on the powers of the police to make the arrest inside, the power of the state to make that arrest.
Even if there is such a thing as citizen's arrest, I think it was part of this record that they do not want confidential informants to go making arrests, so that the police distinguish the confidential informer.
That's correct, Justice Ginsburg. Both the Solicitor General and the petitioners agree that confidential informants should not and would not be making these arrests. So the function of the confidential informant is really, as I said, just a surveillance device. And what's important is not what he's doing, but what the police are doing who are outside.
But going back to why should we decide this question, particularly in Fourth Amendment cases when these issues will come up on suppression motions. So there isn't a need to decide them in the civil context.
Well, I think in general we're talking about a very small category of cases like this one, where the criminal defendant won on the Fourth Amendment, and then the police bring up some new argument on a qualified immunity defense, because if there would already be some law on the question if it were decided in the criminal case. So in those limited circumstances, it seems to put too much of a thumb on the scale on the side of police to say, well, you could come up with some new theory, and you don't even have to show that it applies. All you have to show is that nobody has ever rejected your theory, and then it's not clearly established. And I don't think in this small number of cases the balance should really tilt that far toward police. And here it's certainly not, where the Solicitor General and the petitioners both agree that the court should decide both questions. The constitutional question here is not very difficult. It's, and it boils down to, in the absence of exigent circumstances, could any reasonable officer have believed that the two circumstances they would like to see in previous cases, that is, that a confidential informant is inside and that he sent a signal out that there's probable cause, do those make any difference whatsoever to the calculation of whether there are exigent circumstances or consent? The answer is no, and no reasonable officer could have believed otherwise. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sturber, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you. The colloquy about the safety concerns when the officer or the confidential informant are in the home, I think, highlight why the distinction between a confidential informant and the officer really doesn't make much meaningful headway in terms of the Fourth Amendment. Obviously, if a police officer was acting undercover in this particular situation, he would not have announced. There were three arrestees that actually were in the premises at the time of the follow-up entry. He would not have said after the drug transaction occurred, oh, by the way, I'm a police officer, I'm here to arrest you, for obvious reasons, connoting safety and other issues which would have been attendant to that. Similarly, this confidential informant isn't going to do that either. For the same particular problem, even if this confidential informant had arrest powers under state law. The whole issue is the police officer can call up for backup and assistance to effectuate the arrest, which is precisely what occurred here. Similarly, there's no real distinction then to be drawn between a confidential informant as a government actor allowing for the additional entry or follow-up entry of additional officers for backup and assistance to make sure the arrest is safe and secure than if you have a police officer. Second point I'd like to make is the first time any federal circuit drew this distinction between a confidential informant and a police officer was the Tenth Circuit decision. They adopted consent once removed. They just limited it to a police officer. Obviously, the police officers involved in this case could not reasonably be expected to anticipate such a distinction being drawn, especially given the fact that there was at least the Seventh Circuit body of law, the Sixth Circuit body of law, and as we argue, which we think is a fair reading of Bramble, because they cite the Seventh Circuit body of law that includes a confidential informant, there were at least three circuits that had rejected that distinction. And Yoon in 2000 confirmed that in the Sixth Circuit, there is no distinction as a matter of this particular doctrine between a confidential informant and a police officer. And finally, with respect to the exigent circumstances cases, and you can look at any one that were cited by the respondent, there is no mention of Lewis. There is no mention of consent once removed. There is no mention of any abrogation of privacy. Those issues were not raised, just like the issues were not raised in the criminal appeal of Mr. Callahan's conviction. And so, therefore, they're really not relevant, they're not probative, and we're not suggesting this is an exigent circumstances case, nor are we suggesting relying on, for purposes of the Fourth Amendment issue, any implied consent. We have rested our justification for the Fourth Amendment issue on search incident and also the Lewis doctrine, because we think this is Lewis' case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.